From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. They lock the door to their rooms, roll their eyes, text, text, text. Welcome to adolescence. You made your parents live through it, now the tables are turned, and the world is a lot more complicated than when you were a teen. More online dangers, new pressures on top of the challenges teens have always faced. Are you in survival mode? Help is on the way. This hour on Point Survival Tips for parents. You can join us on air or online. Are you in the throes of this with your teenager? Getting the silent treatment, shutting out of their, being shut out of their bedrooms. Joining me from Austin, Texas this hour is Sarah Villanueva, professor of psychology in the School of Behavioral and Social Sciences at St. Edward's University and author of The Angst of Adolescence, How to Parent Your Teen and Live to Laugh About It. Let's hope so. Sarah, nice to have you with us. Thank you.
Thank you. Hi, Jane.
And with me in the studio, Rob Evans, psychologist and executive director of the Human Relations Service in Wellesley, Massachusetts. He is author of Family Matters, How Schools Can Cope with the Crisis in Child Rearing. Nice to have you, Rob.
I'm glad to be here.
So we'll start with you. The new school is beginning. Many families are moving from a relaxed pace to a kind of a full speed ahead, if you will. More homework, a lot of after-school activities. It's a real period of adjustment and stress for some families, Rob. You've worked with a lot of kids, a lot of parents. How do you see adolescents navigating it?
Well, the honest truth is I see adolescents navigating it on the whole pretty well. And for parents, it's often a very mixed bag because there is a part of the parents that are very glad to be rid of the kids, to be honest with you, to have them be off to school. All the preparation, all the anxiety, all the fuss, all the anticipation, all that stuff begins to mount up. And lots of parents find it very challenging. The kids themselves often find themselves somewhere between excited and challenged. And depending on the child, depending on the family, you have a huge range of reactions that people can have.
Sarah, it's fair to say, based on what Rob just said, that teenagers are certainly under more pressure today than ever before. So many stress points, technology, of course, which we'll get to, but so many kids are also tracked earlier, right? In school,
That's
in extracurricular
right.
activities. They want to get on track sooner. How do you see that changing the landscape for teenagers today?
Well, you know, the context of where teenagers are growing up and the pressures, as you mentioned, are really immense today. So teenage angst and all that comes with it is not new. That's not a novel idea. But compared to when we were all teenagers, the world has shifted and changed. And teenagers today find themselves on constantly via social networking sites, the web. So talk about, you know, peer pressure in a mega scale, right? Mm-hmm. On top of that, you're right. Tracking in schools and expectations from parents, et cetera, make it so that teenagers often feel that they basically need to have their whole lives figured out by the time they're even out of junior high school. And that's a lot of pressure.
Rob, you've said that it used to be that society was changing slowly enough so parents felt that they could prepare their kids for the future. Right now, the future in many dimensions is quite unpredictable. How does that affect how we're raising our adolescents today?
Well, I think it makes a huge difference because the irony here is that the faster things change, even when they change for the better, and the more opportunities that are open for kids in terms of what they want to become and where they want to live and how they want to live, those opportunities can be fabulous and unprecedented in human history, but they don't make it easier to be a parent and to actually know what's good for my kid now. So in the schools I visit across the country, what they've been seeing for years is essentially a growing kind of epidemic of anxiety and lack of confidence among parents, even when their kids are doing well, because the parents are uncertain about exactly what's the best thing for them now. In the days when things that Sarah just mentioned, when things were less complex and less hurried, I'm sure parents had their own worries, but it was not the same as what they're up against today.
And Sarah, any sort of parental anxiety certainly filters down to kids.
It absolutely does. And I always tell parents that it's one of the best things to think about is just remember how it felt being in their shoes. And talk to them, right? I mean, I'm not talking about forcing them to have discussions that they don't necessarily want to have, but just, you know, having the informal check-ins and reiterating to them, reinforcing the idea that I know that it's tough out there for you, and it sucks that you're under pressure. And, you know, just sort of relate to them early on. Talk early, talk often, and check in.
Good. We'll get to some of that communication a little bit later. Rob, I want to turn to the neuroscience. You're not a neuroscientist, but in a nutshell, I mean, neuroscience and common sense tells us that teenagers are characterized by, you know, intense, erratic emotions. What's happening in the brain of a teenager that seems to change them?
Well, you know, the behavior is pretty much the behavior that we've always seen. We just used to attribute it to the kids somehow as if they were motivated to do it. And I think what the evidence is showing increasingly is that there are parts of the adolescent brain which are functioning at a highly adult level, that are very good at computing and thinking fast and doing all sorts of skills cognitively and so on. But it's also true that their brains are more labile. They're more responsive to over-responsive to hormonal input. They're also more, they haven't yet, it turns out, fully developed. We used to think they were kind of done much earlier than it turns out the brain is done. And so lots of the things that we eventually acquire, for example, the capacity to control impulses, for instance, that sort of thing, are not fully developed in the adolescent brain. And part of the risk-taking and other sorts of behavior we see that we worry about turns out actually not just to be their fault or because they're just something or other, but actually it has partially to do with what's going on in their brains.
Right, which explains, Sarah, why adolescents seem to be on an emotional roller coaster so much of the time.
That's right. So as Rob pointed out, there, despite the major cognitive advances that occur during the teen years, what neuroscientists have discovered is that that's true. The adolescent brain is not fully developed until the early to mid-20s. And so the prefrontal cortex, the part of the brain responsible for controlling impulses, emotions, forming judgments, isn't fully formed. So this immaturity manifests in a couple of different ways. Using MRI studies, researchers have investigated teens' reactions to facial expressions compared to adults. And what they found was that adults could correctly identify a given facial expression as fear, for example, whereas teens incorrectly interpreted the facial expression as anger, shock, or surprise. Hmm. And what's more is that adults and teens responded to these facial expressions using different parts of the brain. The adults use the more reasonable frontal cortex, and the teens use the gut reaction emotional amygdala. So results like these help us to explain why teens have such erratic emotions, et cetera. But, yeah, I mean, teens, they are on a bit of a roller coaster, it seems as though, right? So in the cognitive domain, they get to a point where they question all sources of information. These are really advances, right? But ask any parent of a teen and they know that the sources of information are always being questioned. And because they question everything, nothing seems to be stable. Then you factor in social variables such as always being on via SNNs, pressure to do well in school, good old parent-adolescent conflict, all mixed with the awkward and gangly physical changes that come with puberty, and you've got a person who can be giddy one second and furious the next. Mm.
So, Rob, understanding that physiology, understanding actually what's going on in the brain, it's biological, chemical, whatever, helps you better deal with your teenager.
It gives you maybe a different perspective on it, because we all react differently when we think that somebody's behavior, whether it's our own child or someone else, if we read it as won't, it's different than if we read it as can't. And when we're reading our kids always as won't, they won't do this, they won't do that, they won't do the other, it's different than if we sometimes can say, well, actually, maybe they can't. However, if what they're doing is still incredibly annoying or really frustrating, it's not going to stop being annoying or frustrating just because we can attribute some of it to more of those kind of changes that Sarah just nicely summarized. So I think it helps, but it doesn't remove a lot of the stress of being a parent. And I think, actually, Jane, there's one other thing we ought to add here. You know, A, large numbers of adolescents don't trouble their parents constantly. Mm-hmm. They're subjected, they subject their parents to this intermittently. And there's a smaller, though very significant number who do cause lots more trouble. And in the end, as Sarah sort of alluded to a couple minutes ago, the good news is that sooner or later they pass out of it. They get to be 25 and suddenly you look a lot better to them than you did when they were 15.
Sarah, you've had three teenagers who've successfully made it to the other side, still one at home. What have you learned that you would do differently?
Well, that's a good question.
It's a great question, isn't it, Sarah? It's a great question.
I'll give it to you too, Rob. Yeah, You're not off the hook.
It's all Sarah's.
Hindsight is always 20/20, right? So now I could just absolutely be the perfect parent. No, I don't think there's such a thing. I always talk about how my oldest daughter, Susan, got short end of the stick when it comes to parenting. And now my youngest son, Gabe, is, he's much luckier with some experience under my belt. I think what I would have done, though, is I would have gained a little more perspective in terms of, communication with them, and not underestimate the fact that even as young children, they understand much more than we give them credit for. So giving them information and knowledge so as to prepare for what's coming down the pike in terms of developmental issues and different transitions that you're going to experience, and not just the individual child himself, but as the dyad in the family, we're going to go through some ups and downs, and it's all good.
Well, we're going out on Nirvana, Smells Like Teen Spirit, as we talk about the challenges of parenting teens. The slammed doors, the rolled eyes, all the rest of it. You can join us. Have you caught your kids online long after they should have gone to sleep? What about all that technology? Are you constantly drawing a line in the sand just for it to be ignored? I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. We're talking about anxious teenagers and the challenges of parenting them this hour. You can join the conversation. What's your biggest challenge with your teen? Teenagers, what drives you crazy about your parents? You can follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Here's a scene from the 2015 movie Inside Out. Young Riley has just finished her first day of school. With her main emotions, joy and sadness lost somewhere in her mind, anger, fear, and disgust must take over her behavior and actions. Here's that.
School was great, all right?
Riley, is everything okay?
Sir, she just rolled her eyes at us.
What is her deal? All right, make a show of force. I don't want to have to put the foot down.
No, not the foot.
Riley, I do not like this new attitude.
Oh, I'll show you attitude, okay?
No.
Stay happy!
What is your problem? Just leave me alone.
And here's a trailer from the 2012 movie This Is 40. Two parents, played by Paul Rudd and Leslie Mann, try to get in control of their family.
We have decided to cut back on all of the electronics we use.
What?
You need to get outside more.
You could build a fort.
Do what in the fort?
You need to develop your imagination. You don't need technology.
No technology.
Charlotte, put that down.
We are talking this hour with Sarah Villanueva, professor of psychology in the School of Behavioral and Social Sciences at St. Edward's University, and author of The Angst of Adolescence, How to Parent Your Teen and Live to Laugh About It. And with me in the studio, Rob Evans, psychologist and executive director of the Human Relations Service in Wellesley, Massachusetts. He is author of Family Matters, How Schools Can Cope with the Crisis in Child Rearing. After hearing that last clip, I want to go right to social media. Growing up in the age of cell phones and texting, the teenage online world is large. It is consuming, Sarah. These kids have always got to be on. How does constant connectivity lead to stress?
Well, teens are complicated, right? I mean, at least seemingly so. Parents ask me all the time, why are teens so completely invested in social media? I mean, especially when they have real live people they can socialize with. Well, first we have to remember that technological devices that access the web in general, and certainly social networking sites in particular, they're extremely cool, especially to teens who take great pride in having the latest and greatest and expensive gadgets and other status symbols. But also, there are lots of studies that have linked social networking sites and activity online to lots of important psychological structures, both positive and negative, like identity formation, popularity, acceptance, autonomy, etc. But the bottom line is that adolescents are primarily interested in participating in new trends. So teens today are simply doing what they do best, which is socializing. They're vying for position and status in their social world. They're building an image. So this concept is far from original, but what is new is the way in which the fraternizing is being done. This contemporary version of socializing doesn't involve just one teen talking to another teen on a landline for phone and on a phone for hours. But today, teens are much more advanced and significantly more efficient. However, that comes with a potential price because the fact that they're always on, they have a much larger audience. And, you know, they feel as though, true or not, they feel as though they're constantly being judged. And that's exhausting after a while. So they don't call these kids digital natives for nothing. They're always on. And so it can be really stressful and exhausting to them.
Rob Evans, there's a real downside. As you well know, to social media, we had some friends share a devastating story of their 15-year-old who was caught up in what their local police called a sextortion case. You know, boys extorting nude text photos of girls in the high school. This is a brave new world. How do you even begin to navigate?
Well, I think there's a couple of things. First, there are clear limits to what we can do. Second, it's hard for us to know down the road the full impact. I'm old enough to remember when Elvis was dangerous. You couldn't show him below the waist on national TV because he wiggled his hips in a way that seems just cute today.
Right.
And now he's easy listening. And there was a psychiatrist testifying to Congress that comic books were dangerous to children's mental health in the 1950s. So I think we need to have a grain of salt first. Second, and the sexting, for example, it's clear that when it's extorted, the example you just gave, and when it's pressured, it's one thing. And when it's kids experimenting, it turns out the impact on them is not always what we adults imagine it to be. But that said, I think one of the things that parents often pull back from too much is a willingness to set what limits they can on kids' use of the technology they have. So understanding that parents don't have anywhere near complete control, it is possible to say you can be online an hour after your homework's done for an hour. You can be online with your phone, but not now. And many, many parents who don't like what's happening are reluctant to assert themselves.
So setting limits, Sarah, but so what does that mean? You know, are you on the social media networks that your kids are on so you can monitor them? I mean, how much surveillance? I mean, I'd be doing that all day long.
Yeah, that's really hard because, I mean, the second that kids, they have this, you know, old person radar almost. As soon as they see that, you know, their parents or aunts or uncles are on whatever cool site they're on, they're out. And they're like, okay, old people gather here. Now it's time to go. But I agree with Rob that, you know, one of the things that parents should not be afraid to do is to hammer home the message that having cell phones, iPads, et cetera, it's a privilege that can indeed be taken away. It's not a God-given birthright. But also, you know, priorities. Sometimes, you know, kids need to know that in order to access your favorite whatever, social networking site, video, cell phone, that you're supposed to do what's expected of you each day, homework, chores, walking the dog, et cetera, and then limit the time. And that's totally reasonable.
And the parents do not have to win them all in order for their objections and their limit setting to have an impact on their children down the road. The kids may get away when they're out of the house with doing things online the parents don't want, but they know what they're doing is getting away with something their parents don't want. And what this illustrates, Jane, I think, is that technology or anything else, to go back to something Sarah said at the beginning, there is no substitute for relationship with your kids. And what's going to keep them safer in the long run is your relationship and not just whether you have a policy about, say, video games.
A lot of callers here. Davian is in Nashville, Tennessee. Hi, and welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane. Hello to your guests. Very quickly and succinctly, my daughter is 13 today. She has two younger sisters, 10 and 7. my wife and I are from two different backgrounds. I'm African-American from the South. She's white and Korean from the North, so our parenting styles are a bit different. We had an incident this weekend. I'm not proud of the way I handled it, but my daughter at 13... one of the biggest issues we have is not only technology, which we've kind of figured that out by getting an older smartphone, which no longer allows the data plan. She can only talk and text on it, but she can't send photos and she can't upload.
Yeah.
But we just bought her a new one that now will have access to Wi-Fi, so she'll be able to use Wi-Fi at home. But it's an older cell phone, which our carrier no longer supports the data plan. But our biggest issue is the way her emotions and the experts just described so perfectly, and how that makes her treat her younger siblings. And it goes from anger all the way to physical violence if we're not around. And you know, I know sisters and siblings will bicker, but we get calls if we go to the store that, you know, she's, you know, basically abusing the other one. And I'm not quite sure how I respond to that. I know I have to set a tone now because I have to deal with the other ones as they come on. So,
David, it's a great question, and I so appreciate you call. Rob, you jump in here. How does all this screen time affect offline relationships and friendships?
Well, to be honest, Jane, I'm not sure. And without knowing about the caller's situation more specifically, it's hard to say. But I think most of what kids do online is what they do offline, with one exception. The online stuff has been shown repeatedly to sort of desensitize kids, actually all of us. Almost all of us will say and do things online that we wouldn't do in person. So there are ways in which it can affect behavior. But when you have scrapping among siblings and when it reaches a certain kind of serious level about it, I'm not used to that being provoked just by the technology itself rather than other factors between the kids or in the household.
Sarah Villanueva, I'm reading from a study here, one of the longstanding and sturdiest determinants of adolescent well-being, authoritative parenting, with the two essential components of that being structure and warmth. I guess the trick is balancing those. What do you say?
Right. So it is tricky, for sure. Being able to openly, honestly discuss with your child that you have firm standards, that you have expectations, and these are the rules that we follow. No hitting your sister, etc. But being able to do so in a warm, supportive manner, being able to talk to your teen and say, listen, you know, there may be something else going on. I agree with Rob that I don't know of a whole lot of evidence that would suggest that what she may be encountering online or on her cell, text, etc., would cause her to necessarily do these things with her younger sibling. But having that conversation as a parent and saying, look, we have standards and we have expectations for you, but at the same time, we want to allow you the ability to tell us what's going on with you, and let's figure this out together.
There's a second thing, Jane, that's worth adding here, which is kids learn much more from the example parents set than from the sermons parents preach. And while that doesn't mean parents have to be perfect by any means, it does mean that if you're going to give lectures and sermons and they don't match up with the example they see from you, this has nothing to do now with Damien and with the call, but just the thought, the example made me think of it, that we need to think not just about what will we say to our kids, how will we talk with them, but what kind of example are they seeing from us?
They follow
Absolutely.
What you do, not what you say.
Yes.
Cynthia from Newport News, Virginia. You're on the air. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Jane. I have a 13-year-old. Daughter who, first of all, I'd like to make mention, has started wearing glasses due to looking at a screen too much. So that's just out there for any parent to know that that can very well happen, and that's what's happened to my daughter. But secondly, we've gone through a very rocky last 4 years, family situation with divorce and all, and she has withdrawn herself and gone into her social media, which isn't just texting. It's, I mean, she's talking to kids, and I know they're kids. I've seen them on screen. They play a lot of their, she's a gamer. She's a socially through the game. She's got a lot of kids all over the world. And I'm very fortunate that I have a very sweet, nice girl that, trust me, I'm an artist myself, and I have seen where, and you talk about, you know, what you model. As an artist, I get it. ADD. I can totally get into my art for hours, and when I get disrupted, I get short-tempered. And I see that with my daughter, and I think probably any teenager that's, or anyone, focused so much intently on anything, that break of concentration She has a short temper with her 5-year-old brother.
You see it. You see it. I get it. Cynthia, thank you so much for the call. I mean, Cynthia talked about her daughter being withdrawn. Sarah Villanueva, talk about communication, not just withdrawing from because of social media, but just because you're a teenager. I mean, communicating with adolescents can be like knocking your head against a wall. How was your day?
It can.
Fine.
Absolutely.
What did you do?
That's right.
Nothing. Kids who were once good communicators suddenly clam up. What do you do?
Right. Well,
Sarah, you're getting all the good questions. I love this. This is great. Keep it
jump
up.
Jump on in, Rob.
This is good.
There was an article in the New York Times, when teenagers bristle at the question, how is your school? And what I love about this article is that it does a nice job of suggesting to parents that put yourself in their shoes, right? So the caller did a nice job of saying, hey, I can relate. I'm an artist. I experience the same thing. So maybe conveying that to your teenager. I mean, I'm all about communication from the time that they're talking, right? I mean, just starting communication early on and often about anything and everything.
But when they're talking, but when they're talking back, Rob, when they're rolling their eyes, you're getting the silent treatment, all that standard teenage fare.
Well, you know, I think some of it, part of what's hard for us these days is to live with it. And we keep imagining that if we just did this, or we just did that, or we just did the other, they would stop doing this and we'd have a more reasonable community. And I think there are limits about that. And you know, Jane, we react not just to something anyone says or does, but to the meaning of what they say or do, which is different depending on who they are, who we are, and so on. And if the meaning to us is my kid is abandoning me and I'm never going to have a relationship with him again and whatever, that's very different from it's, gee, this is hard, but he probably is going through a phase and we may need to sort of, you know, wait it out a little bit. And I think what's hard for lots of parents these days is to be patient and not to want to try to have to fix everything today.
Not give up either. Mm. I mean,
yes.
Parents are saying, well, gosh, I don't know. I don't want to have that conflict, or I don't want to get into that awkward situation.
Yes.
And so they just avoid it altogether. And this is when they need you the most.
Alan is in Buffalo, New York. Alan, you're on the air. Welcome.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
I was wondering, I hear in terms of mood in general, not for teenagers in particular, mood and disposition, that sometimes external factors like a more balanced diet can help with anxiety or exercise or a better routine. Do any of these things tend to make the situation not as bad?
Ellen, thank you so much. Rob, we're going to break here. Get in an answer.
I don't have any info about that at all. I have to honestly say I'd be lying if I did, that those sorts of things make a huge difference. There may be evidence about it, but Sarah, what do you say?
Well, I think there's some evidence behind sleep for sure.
Oh, sleep, yes.
So adolescents are notorious for not sleeping. They're always in the negative when it comes to sleep and rest. And, of course, they eat a lot of junk food and don't eat as many of the fruits and veggies as they should. But sleep definitely is something that has shifted in adolescence, where their circadian rhythm has been pushed back. And, of course, technology doesn't help there either if they're on texting at 1 o'clock in the morning when they're supposed to be resting. But that's something that parents can do something about in terms of bedtime checking in the cell phones in the evening in the kitchen, because sleep is really important, and that definitely is something that has a correlation to behavior and interactions with the family.
All right, Rob, I asked Sarah before the first break. Now you get it before the second. You have several teenagers that are grown now. What would you do differently?
Both my boys are grown, yes. And what would I do differently? I'd be more patient. I'd be more willing to recognize that they come out different and they are the way they are and you can't change their temperament. And I would probably have given them a little more slack about certain things. I would have tried a little harder than I did, although I thought I worked hard at it, but I'd have tried a little harder to pay as much attention as I could to their strengths and a little less attention to trying to perfect them.
This On Point podcast and following message are brought to you by Goldman Sachs. For answers to the world's most pressing economic questions, from the evolution of consumer preferences to the reasons for price swings in the oil market, tune in to Exchanges at Goldman Sachs, the firm's podcast. Each episode features in-depth discussions with some of the firm's leading experts on the markets, evolving industries, and the global economy. Subscribe to Exchanges at Goldman Sachs on iTunes, Stitcher, or SoundCloud, or listen at gs.com/podcast.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the highs and lows of parenting adolescents this hour, and you can join the conversation. What's your question for our parenting experts? Are you on the other side of this? If so, what worked? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. We're speaking this hour with Sara Villanueva, author of The Angst of Adolescence, How to Parent Your Teen and Live to Laugh About It. And with me in the studio, Rob Evans, author of Family Matters, How Schools Can Cope with the Crisis of Child Rearing. Here's a clip from the 2003 version of Freaky Friday. Anna, played by Lindsay Lohan, discovers the door to her room is missing. She confronts her mom, played by Jamie Lee Curtis.
Where's my door?
Privacy is a privilege, Anna.
Where's my door, Mom?
Your door will be returned to you, Anna, if and when.
I need my door! You give me that door, or I will kill myself!
And here's a trailer from the 2010 movie The Kids Are All Right with actresses Julianne Moore and Annette Bening as the mothers of Laser, played by Josh Hutcherson.
Hey, Bug.
Don't be back late.
I know.
Come give us a hug before you go.
Hugs.
Hug her. That's what she's there for.
Give me my door back. That's my favorite line of the day. Let's go to Shane in Buxton, Maine. Hi, Shane. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hey, Jane.
Hey.
I am a 13-year-old, and I have a dad who is very commanding over the internet.
Okay. What are your limits, Shane? What does he let you do? What does he not let you do?
Certain times a day, he'll turn off YouTube and other sites if he wants me to do something. Or if he's mad at me, he'll just straight off up turn the internet off.
Are there things you do, Shane, behind your dad's back that he doesn't know about?
Not too often, no, but, you know, every once in a while.
Mm-hmm. And what would you say about how your friends are dealing with social media? Is there sort of another universe you guys are in that your parents don't know about?
I have no idea how they really feel about that. I don't really use social media that much. I just use YouTube and, you know.
What's the hardest thing, Shane, about growing up today? Would you say you're 13? What's the most difficult part?
Well, most kids around my age are very reliant on, you know, social media, on YouTube and all these sites, and if my dad is going to turn it off, you know, that kind of, you know, it's like if you took food away from your pet.
Okay. Shane, thank you. Rob Evans is nearly on the floor over here. Rob, your response.
I don't know what to say, Jane, but it's a great summary, almost like you took food away from the pet. You know, this is it's so nice that she called. I think you really these are dilemmas, and you have to work them out one by one, and you can't really just prescribe stuff that everybody's going to do. You have to know the relationship. You have to know the person. You have to know the kid. You have to know the parents. I mean, you have to have a way somehow to help people work it out in their own way and in their own space and time. And what works in one place doesn't always work in another. And the honest truth is that telling nervous parents to relax or laid-back parents to step it up can sometimes be technically accurate, but it, in my experience, it doesn't usually result in huge sustained behavior change. And so part of what you have to find a way to do is to work in each family with the existing strengths they have, both the parents and the kids, and see if you can help them put this together.
Mm. One article really caught my eye in research for this hour, Sara, was from the New York Times with a headline that said, "Can teenage defiance be manipulated for good? Adolescents being receptive to messages of defiance." So, for example, in the article, an anti-smoking ad that made not smoking seem like an act of rebellion against greedy corporations was very effective. What do you say about that?
Well, I thought it was it was pretty genius. Mm-hmm. Although the second that teenagers realize they're being manipulated in this way, well, they're there goes that whole process. But yeah, I think it's really great to tap into the things that are motivating teenagers to do what they do. And we know that they question authority. We know that they are seeking independence and autonomy, and they want to be heard. And so those are really, really great characteristics to tap into. And I think it was interesting the way the article phrased it, that they made the junk food and all the things that are typically associated with things that attract them the bad guy, and had them sort of stand up and say, no, fight the man, right? And I think that was really excellent. It was brilliant.
Let's get another caller in here, David in Charleston, South Carolina. Hi, David, you're on the air.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
Hi, guest. My comment is, you know, my daughter's 16, and I've gone through the last 4 years have been very, very challenging. She struggles with depression and anxiety, tremendous social anxiety. She and I are very, very close. She pretty much tells me everything, and I'll say, the world out there for teens today is something I don't think any adult has any notion of, and the things that they are fraught with every day. And there are so little resources. You know, my daughter, you know, sees a therapist because, you know, we've determined that that's something that she really wants to do. But it's so hard to find. There are so few therapists out there for teens, and there are so few that accept insurance. And it's such a tragedy that these kids, and I know so many of her friends who struggle and have absolutely no resources. They can't go to their parents, and they are just alone in these world of tremendous anxiety. And it's just really hard for them.
I'm glad you brought that up, David. Thank you. It's a real problem, Rob Evans.
Yes, and what I do is be the executive director, actually, of a community mental health clinic that serves children and families. And we know firsthand how much demand there is, how much need there is, and how hard it is to meet it. And over the last 15 years, there has been a huge gap between the growing need for kids to get that kind of help that the caller just mentioned and what the actual availability of resources is. And it's something that those of us in the field struggle with constantly. And it's actually not just a local problem in Charleston or here in Boston. In my travels, it's nationwide.
Sarah, I agree. I mean, I see it a lot. Depression and anxiety, near epidemic among adolescents.
Mm-hmm. That's absolutely true. And it is really important, I think, for parents and even others who struggle, peers or parents of their peers, to really convey to the teen that they're not alone. There are lots of folks that are struggling in this same way. And even if it were an informal setting where they could gather some friends that are experiencing the same issues, I think one of the things that would help teens is to know that they're not alone. And the parents, too. You know, I mean, lots and lots of parents are out there struggling with this same situation. And I think part of helping people is just knowing that they're not alone and there are other folks out there struggling, looking for resources. But it's true. It's a real problem in the whole country.
Here's Dennis in Green Bay, Wisconsin. Hi, Dennis. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi. I think this has been a problem for every generation. I went through it with my parents. I went through it with my kids. Every teenager, I think, closes themselves off at some point. And either because of the parents or in spite of them, somehow they turn out to be good, normal humans. And the kids now someday will face the same issues with their kids, I believe.
Somehow they'll make it through, Dennis. I appreciate the sentiment. Thank you very much. Kevin in Boston, you're on the air. Welcome.
Hi.
Hi.
How's it going?
Well, thank you.
So one thing I do want to say, I'm 24 years old. I have a son of my own that he's 2.5 years old. But I also have two siblings, a boy and a girl, which are both teenagers. And one thing I've noticed is that the amount of patience that you showed the children, the teenagers, because it doesn't just start when they're teenagers. I believe that it really starts when they're really a toddler, because as a toddler, you begin to observe, and you're like a sponge. And everything that everybody does and says, they're almost recording. And not just language, body movements, the way they react and blow up to situations. I feel like being able to have the patience and the dedication to show the child the way things should be, I think really helps out a lot. Not just that, though, but even taking time to do little things with them, you know, coloring, asking them questions, and, you know, doing things that they like rather than forcing them to do things that you may not necessarily know if they like or not.
It's all about the relationship. No, Kevin, I hear you, and I'm so glad you called. Thank you very much. Let's get one more in here. Allie in Lincoln, Nebraska. Hi, Allie. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
So I wanted to call in because I had a really, really rough teenagehood. I'm 25, so I was part of the AOL Instant Messenger group. And, you know, I remember the cyberbullying going on even with that. But it was also a really good outlet because, you know, the kids who were embarrassed to be friends with me and, you know, quote-unquote real life, mm-hmm. Were actually really supportive when I talked to them online. The other thing is I am a stereotypical perfectionist, and I'm now in recovery from an eating disorder. But things really got underway when I was about 13, and they just kind of went downhill from there until I was in college and finally had to get some help. So I kind of
And so, the, Allie, the lesson from your child, from your teenage years is?
I think that there's a fine line between, you know, being hands-off with your kids so that, you know, you're not perceived as being pushy and invasive. And being a little bit disengaged. And I think one of the things that's really important for parents to watch for when they've got teenagers is if there's some kind of radical change in the way they're achieving at school or their friend group or, you know, frankly, the way that they're dressing. I mean, mm-hmm. I know that mm-hmm. teenagers go through stages. I had my little goth phase.
But watch for the changes. It's another good point, Allie. Again, thank you for calling, and good luck to you as you move forward. You know, you heard Rob a lot in that call there. It's a tightrope, right?
It is a tightrope, and there are times when it is really, really good to be disengaged, to be honest. That is to not get fired up about everything, that your child comes home and says, the coach was unfair to me. Oh, my goodness, let me call the coach. And there's other times when you really need to assert yourself and you always want to stay in touch and be in tune. And I think one of the things that parents find exhausting sometimes about parenting is how much they feel they have to worry about and monitor and track and all of that. And ironically, there are times when it really is good to let go and other times when you need to be right on top of it. And finding out how to draw that line is a real dilemma. And I think, to be honest, any of us who've been parents encounter that dilemma not once, but over and over.
Sarah Villanueva, one big challenge with the school year is getting your adolescent actually up in the morning, out of bed. Can you talk about the teenage clock and why it seems so out of sync with a very early school schedule?
Right. Well, the research has shown that the circadian rhythm that dictates our sleep schedules is pushed back during the teenage years. And so just when they should be getting ready for bed and getting sleepy, actually adolescents are just sort of ramping up. And it doesn't help that they have technology that keeps them sort of motivated and excited to stay up and play video games with other people all over the world, for example. But what that does then is it makes it extremely difficult to then proceed the next day on a school day to get them up and to get moving. And this has been a real challenge for lots and lots of parents out there because it's a battle. It will cause a battle with teens. But again, I think if we can talk to our teens up front before we even get the cell phones and before we even get to the battle part, to talk about how, look, these are the expectations and I will get you a phone and you can spend some time, but let's agree right now that before you go to bed, these are the rules that we have. You can check in your cell phone here and we expect you to get some sleep. And I know it's difficult, right, because they don't actually get sleepy till much later. Melatonin levels don't actually spike until about between midnight and 1 a.m. for teenagers as opposed to adults whose melatonin starts to spike at about 10 p.m. So we have to understand that, but also help them to not make it worse by just, you know, being online and playing video games.
Let's get John in here from Atlanta, Georgia. Hi, John. Very little time left, but please go ahead quickly.
Hey, James. How are you doing?
Fine, thanks.
I have a 14-year-old daughter that lives about 400 miles away. She's lived that way for about 3 years. And, you know, at first it was okay, and now she's getting older. It's becoming more and more difficult to communicate with her. And I'm just kind of at a loss as to what to do with the distance between us, because it's not like I see her every day.
John, thank you. Rob Evans, a lot of parents deal with this for sure.
Lots of parents do, and it's very hard without knowing the specifics to be able to say something that's honestly useful. I think the honest truth is that even when the kids don't live 400 miles away, there are lots of times at this age when they get more distant, when they have less to say, when they're less interested in talking, when relating to them can be harder. And I think it's just compounded when you have the extra measure of distance. And I think a lot of times all you can do is kind of stay and be available and try to be in touch and expect that you're not going to get as much response as you would wish, and hope that, in fact, as time passes and they get older, you'll have a chance to reconnect by not having been cut off.
I've got about 30 seconds here. Sarah Villanueva, my dad used to say, little kids, little problems, big kids, big problems. What would you have us know about raising adolescents today? What's the one thought you would leave with us?
That they are definitely awesome. They're going through some major transitions, and I'm at the point now where I actually miss some of the things that I used to pull my hair out for.
Irma Bombeck used to have a column, Sarah, which she called all the things she yelled at her kids that they finally did, like grow up and act your age.
That's right. Well, I mean, you know, having to yell at someone for not picking up those socks again. I now wish that I had the socks on the floor so that we can engage in some one-on-one interaction.
What about you, Rob?
What about me? I would say this: the most important lessons most of us learn in life, we learn in a context of loss or disappointment or failure, and not because we win the lottery. The same thing's going to be true of our children, and we have to be willing to realize that what's going to distinguish them is not whether this happens, but how they react. And we need to give them a chance, as much as we can stand, to do the learning they need to learn.
And appreciate them along the way.
Yes.
Rob Evans, Sarah Villanueva, thank you so much. Excellent hour and interesting insights. Listeners, thank you as well. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.